With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to Life in the Stocks, episode 288. Today is Thursday, the 8th of June, and my guest for this episode is world-renowned rock photographer Mick Hudson, who sadly passed away 1 week ago today on June the 1st. I only found out about Mick's death last night. I still don't know how he passed away. I don't know what happened. I'm not going to speculate on what happened because it's not my place to. But this conversation with Mick that you're about to hear was recorded about 5 or 6 weeks ago now. And he seemed, when I last spoke to him, to be in good spirits and good health. And so obviously the news of his death for me and for everybody, I'm sure, who knew him, came as a real shock. And there's been some lovely tributes to him on Facebook and social media, and also on the Metal Hammer website. Mick's a photographer who's worked for Metal Hammer for many, many years. I first met him 10 years ago and we immediately hit it off. I recently lost my job on Kerrang Radio, and I'd actually been invited by a publicist friend of mine, Tony Cook, who's an absolute sweetheart and has always been a legend in my life. And when Kerrang Radio was closing down and I found out I was losing my job, Tony was one of the few people who stuck by my side during that time. And he said, "Matt, we're doing this big press trip. We're going out to Germany for this Volbeat concert. Everybody who's coming out is obviously, you know, doing articles and interviews and various press stories on the show. Obviously, you're not going to have a platform to broadcast anything, but I just want you to come along." And so I did. And I was on this bus full of journalists and we were going out to the gig, and yeah, everybody's spirits were high. And I just remember feeling really alone and adrift because I knew my time in the industry, or at least I thought my time in the industry at that point, was coming to an end. And one journalist even said to me on the bus, like, "Ah, at least I've got a job to go home to, mate, at the end of this," which is a horrible dig. And I thought, what a cunt. Mick was the one person we'd never met before, but Mick was the one person who noticed that something was up, that I was quiet. And he was just very caring and considerate and kind and cool towards me. And when we got to the bigger outdoor amphitheater venue in Germany where Volbeat were playing, they were supported by my good friends in Airborne. And I wound up just kind of ditching the crowd and going off to see Airborne. And Mick came with me because he'd photographed them and he was friends with the guys as well. And Mick and I had a great night and we just hit it off and we were chatting all night. And we ended up in this bar till about 6 in the morning, just me and him, just drinking, setting the world to rights. And then, you know, it comes time. It probably long since passed that time, but it came time when the night was coming to an end and I had a flight to catch, and Mick was going straight to London to photograph Jay-Z and Beyonce and Madonna and all these other superstars at the GQ Awards. And I remember just thinking, this guy is insane. I love him. And then a couple of weeks later, it was Download Festival. I'm about to head there myself momentarily. And again, Mick spotted me and he saw that I was a little bit out of sorts and didn't really know where to go, what to do, what to say, because I just lost my job and, you know, I was kind of in a bit of a dark spot. And he just put his arm around me, took me into his little studio on the Download site, gave me a bottle of vodka. He was like, have a bit of this. And then we proceeded to do a photo shoot. And that was my first experience of not only watching Mick at work, but experiencing and being on the other side of his direction and his artistry. And he made me feel like $1 million. He made me feel so big and powerful and confident at a time when I was the opposite of that. And I will never, ever forget that kindness that he showed me in that time. He was such a beautiful man, such an amazing photographer. And we stayed in touch from that moment on. I wouldn't say we were close friends. We didn't hang out a lot, but he would always be very supportive of me whenever I posted stuff on social media about either mental health or addiction. And, you know, we spoke a lot about those things. We talk about those issues in this conversation as well. Mick was bipolar. Mick struggled himself with addiction and alcoholism. And he was always just a beautiful soul and somebody I just hugely respected. He is actually the reason I started getting into photography, was because of him and the way he approached it. I thought I'd like to be able to do what that guy does, even a smidgen of what he does. And so I bought a camera just before COVID and didn't end up using it for ages. And then as gigs started happening again, I've been going out and shooting shows. And I'd actually spoken to Mick about going down to Brighton where he lived and meeting up with him and getting a little crash course in photography and getting him to show me the ropes and hopefully, you know, pass on some of his knowledge and his wisdom and his skills. And we were also talking about working on a photography book together, you know, compiling all the photos and the incredible portraits that he's taken over the years and live shots. Everybody, you can think of any musician, artist of the last 50 or 60 years and Mick photographed all of them. He's such an incredible photographer, such a beautiful human being. And it's just, you know, it's so strange and horrible to think that he's no longer with us. And like I said, this conversation was only recorded a few weeks back and I'd been sitting on it and I'm trying to put out a few more kind of industry behind the scenes guests at the moment. And so I had this episode with Mick all lined up to go out. And then I got home from Austria and saw the news that he died last week. And I was in two minds about whether to put this episode up, because it's a weird one, isn't it? It's obviously going to be the last interview he did before he died. I think it's the only in-depth interview in audio form, at least, that he's ever done. But I feel like to help tell his story and to help keep his memory alive and to pay tribute to him, not just as a photographer and an artist, but as a man, that it's important for me to share this episode with you. So I've decided to put it out. And yeah, it was a beautiful chat and he was in really high spirits and he was hopeful and he was optimistic and we were making plans, as I said, to work on things together. And then whatever happened and now Mick's no longer here. So I don't really have too much else to say. I can feel myself getting a bit choked up. So I'm going to just play the interview, let you enjoy it, and please do share it and help keep the memory of Mick alive and celebrate his work and his contributions to photography and music and art and, you know, indeed just humanity. He was a beautiful, beautiful man. He was complicated. He had his demons. He had his struggles. We bonded over that. And as I said, he was just so kind and awesome to me at a time when I really needed somebody with more experience, not just with mental health, but also with the industry and just life experience. And he was a mentor figure to me, and he will always be that. And I'm just very thankful for the time that I got to spend with him, the conversations that we shared. It's mad that this episode is going out on this day, because on this exact day, 10 years ago, I did my last ever show on Kerrang Radio. And that then set into motion 6 to 8 months of depressive, suicidal, heavy drinking. And I was drinking like I didn't want to live. And that trajectory ended with me waking up on some train tracks that I'd thrown myself onto whilst under the influence with a broken spine. And I nearly died. And I spent 3 months in hospital recovering after that. And I just think back to how low I was at that point. And it took that accident and that near-death experience to remind me of how beautiful and amazing life is. And so even if things do seem like they're the fucking worst they can get right now, I promise you, if you just stick it out, there will be better days ahead. And now I look at my life 10 years on and where I'm at now and everything I've been through and everything I've achieved and experienced and all the amazing relationships and connections that are in my life and the love and the joy that I get to feel because I'm still here and I made that choice to stay here. And I'm glad that I did every day. And I just want to share that with anybody who's feeling hopeless and like that there isn't anything to live for. There is always a reason to live. There is always a reason to persevere and carry on. And there will always, no matter how terrible life can get, there will always be better days ahead. So please hang in there. Please seek help. Please do whatever you've got to do to stay well and stay here. And Mick, wherever you are now, I know Mick was a spiritual person. We spoke about that. And so I hope wherever he is, he's at peace and he's got a smile on his face. And I look forward to a time somewhere down the line in some form of existence, hopefully, where we can meet up and have a hug. And it's heavy stuff, man. But as I said, I felt it was important to share this chat. So here we go. This is Life in the Stocks, episode 288 with Mick Hudson. Mick.
Hello.
I can hear you. I can't see you. If you flip your camera on as well.
Hang on.
Start video.
Oh, yeah. Start video.
There you go.
There you go.
Yes, mate.
Glasses on and everything.
Looking very professional, ready to go. Yeah, cheers to you, mate. Good to see you, man.
How are you? Well, lovely.
Are you on your boat?
I am indeed. Yeah, it's still here. Hasn't sunk yet.
And you get good Wi-Fi on that thing, do you?
Yeah. Yeah, we get good Wi-Fi. I've just got a new girlfriend, so I'm really happy.
Lovely.
Yeah, it's all good.
Dude, I wanted to just dive straight in to the deep stuff because I was thinking about our friendship over the years and we haven't spent many times together, but the ones that we have, for me at least, have been extremely memorable. And I remember, tell me if you remember this, as far as I'm aware, the first time you and I met was in Germany and it was a press trip for a Volbeat show. An outdoor big amphitheater. Airborne was supporting, who are good friends of mine.
I love Airborne, yes.
They're the best. The best dudes, best live bands, best people.
Airborne released in AC/DC.
Yeah. And so at that point, right, I had been told that I was being let go by Kerrang because they were closing the station and they were going online only. And Tony Cook, in his supreme generosity, he's one of the nicest and best people in the business. He said, Matt, seeing as how you know you're gonna be out of work soon, why don't you come on this press trip? I know that you won't be able to do any press from it because you won't have a platform, but just come on the trip and have fun and it'll be great to have you along. So he basically brought me out there just as, you know, a nice gesture. That's the kind of guy he is. And that's when we first met. And you and I, everybody else went home to bed. I don't know if you remember this. But you and I wound up, I think it was in White Trash.
God, where did we wind up? I'm not entirely sure.
I think it was that bar White Trash in Berlin.
Yes. It could have been, yes.
And we were up till, say, 5 or 6 in the morning, right? We were up
I wasn't sleeping that night, I have to say. And I had to work the next day.
Not only work, you had to go and shoot the GQ Awards.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, God. That's your fault.
Well, this is what I was thinking in relation to that story and from what I know of you. You know, and that night, I was so impressed by your stamina. I was like, this guy, I saw a kindred spirit in you. I was like, this guy is full gonzo. Like, he lives and breathes it. You know, he's the real deal.
That's all I've done for 30 years.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, I wouldn't do anything else. And the reason why I wouldn't do anything else is I've met some of the most wonderful people I've ever, you know, in my life. Purely by, you know, staying up until 5 o'clock in the morning. But Yeah, I mean, from being taught how to line dance by Shania Twain. Now, that's a story.
Mate, I'm sure you got stories for days, and we're going to try and get into as many of them as possible.
And yeah, she taught me how to line dance. It was just, you know, there's mad little things that happen. You know, all being on Aussie's tour bus, watching Aussie swear at dogs because they're shitting all over the tour bus. Things like that, you know, little moments of, you know, when it is my time to go, I'll have a couple of grins.
You've led a life that's full, man. And, you know, I'm happy to hear that you wouldn't have it any other way, because what I've learned in my lifetime is that the fun is fun, but it does sometimes come at a cost, and it does take its toll on the wear and tear sometimes.
Two wives, two ex-wives. Yeah.
Relationships suffer, your mental health suffers as well, doesn't it?
Oh, totally, it does. It does, and you probably know this. I had a little bit of a funny thing that went on. But, you know, you find your space, and, you know, through meditation and giving up alcohol, like I know you have done, and giving up everything else, really, really made a change in me. And I'm very happy now.
That's great, man. And you seem like you're pretty, you know, content just from looking at you on the Zoom. It's always hard when you're not in a room with someone to gauge their aura, but, you know, there's a glow, and it's not just the sunlight behind you.
Yeah, it's not just the sunlight behind me. That's my own personal sunlight.
Well, let's go back to the start, mate, and kind of trace your journey. So where does photography begin for you? Because, you know, there's a few people, I'm not going to mention any names, but there's a few well-known photographers who I think just kind of had the fortune to be at the right place at the right time and have had the right access, and their photos aren't actually that impressive. For me, you're an artist and your work is incredible, and some of the photos you've taken are some of, you know, I think the finest portraits and live shots I've seen. So where does your interest in the art form begin?
I was an oilman. I worked on an oil rig. And it's a desperate way to live your life, trust me. And I was always been an artist. I'm from a family of artists. I mean, my great uncle was in Ronnie Scott's band. My mother was an ice skater. My grandmother was a dancer, and also the first female photographer in the First World War.
Wow, that's amazing.
And so,
where did you grow up, Mick? You're from South Shields, right?
I'm from South Shields, from the city of Sarah Millican and the Wild Hearts. Don't let them tell you they're from Newcastle. They're not, because they grew up. Ginger grew up in the street behind me, so that's not true.
Yeah, I've spoken to Ginger about South Shields before. I think he's proud of that fact.
Well, we should be. It's a tiny little place, and we have had everybody from, you know, all the bands you can probably think of, to Formula One teams, to everything coming from this tiny little place. And, you know, the people in South Shields are very proud of where they live. And they're very proud of that little, tiny little village that's on the banks of the Tyne. And, there's some great people come from there.
So how do you wind up on the rigs? Is it because opportunity wasn't exactly varied and all that?
It was quite really simple. I was sent away at school because obviously my parents hated me. And I went to up, and I became very posh and all that kind of stuff, and went to Gordon's, and I started doing a petroleum engineering degree, and this was obviously not going to be the thing for me. So I dropped out of that. That was Imperial. And I dropped out of that. And the next thing I knew, I was on an oil rig to try and sort my head out, which just kind of really validated the point that I really didn't want to do this. So I then picked...
Sorry, the oil rig was almost like a rehab stint for you, was it? Like to
very much so. Yeah, it's like it was great fun. I mean, I'm not going to say anything bad about it, because I love all getting covered in mud and pulling heavy things out of the ground. You know, I love it. But anyway, while I was on the oil rig, I sent a letter to Bournemouth and Poole College of Art and Design, which is possibly the furthest place I could find away from Aberdeen at the time. And I got in.
On the strength of the letter, or what do you think it was?
The strength of the letter and the interview. It was like 3 people for every 1,000 that got in. And I just came in. I didn't even have an auto level. Right? I had nothing, because I was maths, physics, chemistry, biology. You know, that was my thing. On the strength of what I'd done before, because I was always I was always a photographer. You know, I was always interested in photography. I was always interested in hand-drawn art. And I was always interested in the history of art. So I kind of put myself a little portfolio together, and I went down there. And I remember the guy who allowed me in, there were people there who had studied art their entire lives, you know, from very posh schools and all that kind of thing. And he said, we're going to have the oilman. We're going to have the oilman, because I was just like, I wanted to do it, you know. I knew I could do something.
Obviously a bit of a curio for them as well, right? Do you think there was an element of that at play?
Like maybe they were, yeah, maybe they were chancing their arms slightly.
Yeah.
But it was very much a case. I knew I could do this, and I knew I had a lot more. There's so much stuff going on in my head. So I did the degree of photography, film and television. And then I was incredibly lucky to meet up with a guy called David Redfern, who was probably the greatest jazz photographer this Britain has ever had. And that's where I got to go on, take pictures of James Brown, B.B. King.
I was looking at some of those photos earlier today. Chuck Berry, James Brown, B.B. King, unbelievable. So that was some of the first celebrity shots you took.
Very first. Very,
wow.
And then I moved on.
Did you have any one-on-one time with any of those guys?
I had, with Herbie Hancock, I had a day with Herbie Hancock, which was amazing. So there were all these, like, greats that I was just kind of hanging around with. And I was very young at the time, so... You know, and of course, David was the master at that.
How did you two meet, Mick?
What, David and I?
Yeah.
Well, that was, this is 100% true. While I was at college, there was an advert in the British Journal of Photography that David wanted an assistant. So again, just like I did when I was on the oil rigs, I sent him a letter and he invited me in and I became his assistant.
Wow. Just goes to show, man, I've always been a big believer in this philosophy with my career as well, is if you don't ask, you don't get.
Ask and you will receive.
And even if you don't receive, at least you tried.
Well, yeah.
And you know you tried.
I'm a pretty good letter writer, though, I think.
Yeah, persuasive journalism is a skill of yours.
Oh, journalists, so don't get me started on them.
I hope you know, Mick, that I'm not one of them. I've never labelled myself as one of them. I've never identified as one of them. So are you instantly enamoured with the art form? Because I know, right, another day that we shared together was at Download 1 year. And again, it was in a seemingly kind of like quite desperate time in my life. I always seem to have, you know, hung out with you when I've been in a low place, but I was drinking a lot that day. And I remember you kind of, you took me under your wing and we did a shoot.
Your pint off you, actually.
Yeah. Well, you were giving me some vodka as well, straight from the bottle, some Russian vodka.
Have this instead. Yes.
And you took some photos of me, but I just remember
the way you kind of shaped me as your subject and made me feel comfortable and good about myself. Like, you have a really innate ability, which you've obviously cultivated over the years, and you're no doubt aware of this. But from my point of view, having that brief exchange with you in that situation, there's this skill that you have where you bring out.
I would say I'm completely unaware of that.
Right. Well, that's what makes you great, man, is you have this ability to make the subject feel great about themselves and comfortable and just like show off their best qualities, which is obviously what photography is about, isn't it? It's capturing the essence of the human spirit.
Yeah. This is the essence, I think, of what I do is unless you are that person or you can empathy with a person, and good or bad,
mm-hmm.
You'll get the best out of them. In fact, you'll get the best out. Now, I don't do it to take a photograph. I kind of do it because I like them or they like me, and then the photograph or the magic happens. You can't go in there and just think I'm going to do this and push them around, stuff like that. You have to become part of what's happening, and then generally you become invisible and you can do whatever you want.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing, and you know, interviewing isn't the same, but conversations and connections is really what I live for with my work. And there's an element of that, I think, to photography as well, which you've just sort of alluded to there, is forming a human bond with this person.
The end game, you know, the taking the photograph is the end result. You can't get what you want unless you've done all the other things first. And, you know, there are times, you know, touring Japan with Bon Jovi or something like that, where I was invited out to kind of really raucous nights where the journalist wasn't. But I wasn't going to take my camera. I was just part of the fun at that moment. And then you could say a couple of days later, you're sitting on a bullet train with Bon Jovi and he's talking about his wife and he's talking about this and the other. You're taking pictures.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't, you know, left my camera at home the night before.
Yeah, because you connected outside of work on, yes, on a personal level in a meaningful
way. And then when
way.
We knew we had this thing to do, he was very, very, he was so cool. And he was fine about the whole thing. And he was, you know, he was going through a tough time at the time. And we just got on. And I hope, like I did with Lemmy that time when I was going through a very bad time, as we said, and he spotted it, you know. And it's one of my favorite pictures of all time is when a lot of people think that photograph of Lemmy is me interrogating him about his life, and you know, that look on his face is because of what he was saying. It was completely the other way around. He was talking to me and asking me questions. And that, if you look at that picture again, he's actually thinking about what I've said and is coming up with his view on it. It wasn't me asking him, it was him asking me.
I never got to spend any time with Lemmy, which is one of my great sad, you know, regret, I guess regret maybe would be the right word. But yeah, you got to spend so much time with him. How was he as a human? Just a great, great guy.
Just the nicest, gentlest, very gentle. Totally gentle. And I still think to this day, my greatest, probably not my greatest picture, but one of the most meaningful. They used it, you know, when someone is buried and they have a picture at the end of the coffin. That was my picture. So that meant a lot to me.
Yeah, that's huge. You know, that really is everything, isn't it? And as you say, I know when people ask me what's your favorite interview, it isn't always, you know, the one which is maybe objectively the best, but no, it's the one that you remember the most fondly.
I've got pictures of people saying, oh, this is, you know, but I think certain things, like I always say, and I will tell anyone that everybody says, oh, you captured a real moment with him. No, I didn't. He was asking me the questions.
That's the sign of what kind of man he was as well, right? He had that ability to recognize that there was pain going on within you. So can I ask you quickly, Mick, when do you start to notice that you have struggles? Were they always there, or did they surface over time?
The music industry is a terrible thing. They creep up on you. And you do have to take a step out every now and then. Not before a few arguments, which you will probably have with friends and colleagues and work colleagues and things. And then you take a step out and you decide to change your life. And I'm really happy now. You know, one of the funny things about giving up these kind of things is that you do these things to be part of the crowd and to blend in and be all of this music industry bollocks. I'm sorry, I'm not allowed to say that, am I? But you know, and then you realize after a little while of, I mean, not being a part of it. I mean, COVID was a great thing. It meant I couldn't do what I used to do. And so I decided during that period of time to just give it all up. And, you know, I remember walking away from the boat, because I live in a boat, as you know, walking down the gangplank, and I felt really happy. And I hadn't felt happy for so long. And it was great. But I'll never forget that moment walking down the gangplank, feeling happy.
It happens, doesn't it, when you haven't felt that way for so long. I've had similar moments, and just the high that you have from being alive and excited about life.
Well, it's just a, it's
good as any drug.
Felt for so long.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you drink to be happy. You take drugs to be happy. But you weren't. You were taking drugs and drinking because you weren't happy. When you are, you just don't need it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, sober's the new high. I tell you what, though, you must have had some amazing parties and experiences over the years, and there's far too many to list in one show, I'm sure. But one picture, and I guess a story that maybe you know surrounds it, it's one that flashes up all the time, and I'd love to know the sort of the series of events around it. Is the I guess it was the Metal Hammer Awards. You're in like a Jeep or a limousine or something.
Yes.
And it's Dimebag Darrell, Nikki Sixx, Vili Valo. Was Nikki drinking at that point?
Oh, they were all.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I would have assumed that Vili and Dime would have been going for it, but
it was desperate. I mean, to the point that Nikki wanted to drive the 40-foot stretch Hammer through the middle of London. It was just not going to happen. Then Dime, we had champagne glasses and champagne and stuff in the back of the thing. And Dime then started to rip up the leather seats with a broken champagne glass. I mean, poor old Villa, who's the sweetest man in the world, just he was off his tits. But I mean, the fact is, he didn't know what the hell was going on. It was great. You know, I mean, Nikki obviously doesn't drink, doesn't do anything anymore. And is still, I think, one of the, I could speak to him, if you know what I mean, you know, if I needed to about something. Sadly, that Dime is gone. He was always off the chart.
Was he?
Wonderful soul, such a sweetheart. And Vili is just, well, he's just Vili. I mean, you know, nothing affects him. You know, he's like Superman. But it was a great day. We originally were driving to a park to do some shoots, a shoot outside the Hummer. But in the end, that all went a little bit wrong. We just decided to drive around London, which is why we were 2 hours late for the Metal Hammer Awards.
Amazing. And are you cutting loose with them as well? Are you joining in on the fun or are you documenting it?
No, we started to document it and then it all became... In fact, some of my best pictures when I was possibly enjoying it a little bit too much. Especially when they were started throwing champagne glasses around in the back. It was just all great. But yeah, we were 2 hours late for the Metal Hammer Awards.
Love it.
Mainly because we got lost.
I'm sure you didn't miss much. What about Rick Mayall? He, for me, was my absolute hero.
My hero. You see, I have a video. Remember those videos?
VHS tapes.
VHS tape of Kevin Turvey. Because he used to do a thing before he was really before he was famous called Kevin's Ear. And anyway, I bought one of these things way back in the day. And obviously, Young Ones and, you know, all the other things he'd done, you know, Alan Bastard and all those kind of things. He was always just a massive hero of mine. I've even got his signed autobiography.
Bigger than Hitler, better than Christ.
Oh, God.
What a title.
If I could have the guts to have an autobiography that's bigger than Hitler, better than Christ.
Unbelievable.
I signed that. But I went to meet him and we did this great thing in this.
Those photos that you often share of kind of him sat in the theatre chair and that day, was that the first time you'd met?
No, it was the second time we met. But
right.
The first time, you know, you couldn't get a sensible word out of it. Because Aid was there as well. And it was just, I mean, it was just like watching the TV, you know. And I'd come up with this idea that was for the Mail on Sunday and it was for the cover. And I had asked Rick to be serious. And of course, that's just not going to happen. I noticed he was smoking all the time. And we went down to the little cinema area in this private men's club where you could smoke. And I said, I bet you can't blow a smoke ring. So he was concentrating. And I drew in the cigarette and blew the smoke ring. And I'm watching it and I took the photograph. That's none of this is Photoshop. That was on film. So, you know, I like not to do much in Photoshop. So
you can see that in your work as well, you know, because you can, I think, see those heavily edited, highly digitized style.
Yeah, you can. I mean, there used to be a guy called Keith Drummond who worked on Q magazine and Select magazine, and his little, you know, speciality was spotting what was shot in digital and what wasn't, and he could do that. You know, he was a brilliant art editor. He could just spot it. Anyway, so he did this smoke ring, and he's looking through the smoke ring. Of course, then he burst out laughing, but that one moment is him being serious and concentrating. And I love that book.
He seemed to have real depth as well. He did. He was a guest presenter at my university graduation day. And he did this incredible speech about how you only need five things in life. And, you know, he was listing off like essential life skills. And the last one was love. And he was like, all you need is love. Yeah. You know, and he was saying things like all men and women are created equal, so no one is your natural superior, and things like this. And he just, you know, he seemed like man. He had so much heart.
Yeah, he was a very, very deep man, and I almost sometimes used to think that his comedy was. It's a bit like me sometimes when I explode up into some sort of random thing about the universe and the metaverse and all that kind of stuff. I'm just covering something up, which is I don't really understand. And I think he used to do that as well. He would go out into this enormous, you know, he would suddenly, you know, like during the photo session, we would do all this stuff. And then immediately he started dribbling out of his mouth and just like looking like an absolute trout. It's like, why are you doing this? I think that was just his reaction to stuff.
These are all like walls that we put up, aren't they? Because I think people with big hearts are often scared of opening them, you know, and revealing them and exposing them.
Well, I think comedians are the worst for that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like Robin Williams would be a classic example of that. And
obviously, and Robbie Williams, we won't even talk about him. But anyway.
Is he a good guy? Robbie? No?
My lawyer's here.
No comment. Let me ask you this real quick, Mick. Like a while back, I did notice, you know, and I recognized what was happening because I've been through similar situations myself. And I feel like, if it's okay me saying this, I hope you don't mind, there was a while where you were posting certain things on Facebook just to poke the bear and kind of, you know, and just for your own amusement, get a reaction out of people. And I saw it pissing a lot of people off, and I found it amusing because...
Well, I think a lot of people don't have a sense of humor, but I also think they are a lot cleverer than they are. And so it probably wasn't the best period of my life.
But well, yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to say, is it was clear to me that you were only doing that because there was something hurting inside you, because, you know, I've been there and I know.
Well, I hadn't been, you know, it's one of those things. People think of me as a photographer. They don't actually know anything about my background or any of the things I've studied or interested in or maybe have qualifications in or anything. And, you know, some journalist who's lived in his bedroom in Leeds for the last 17 years. Sorry. And I did. And that's a terrible thing of me. And it was, yes.
I don't think it was terrible. I think it is an indication of how delicate people have allowed themselves to become.
Well, yeah, because even at at that time, it was... if somebody come back with a funny comment,
exactly. Yeah.
But they just didn't seem to do it. And there was a couple of years where I just fought with people. But it wasn't because I didn't like them or anything like that or didn't respect them. I just think maybe they weren't maybe involved in their own shit.
Yeah, and I also think, you know, there's a reason why a lot of artists and people who you shoot like you. And I think that in the music industry, when you get on well with artists, a lot of other people in the industry get jealous of that fact.
Very much so.
And so, you know, they get their backs against the wall with almost anything you do, because they're like, "What? Who does he think he is?"
Yeah, here's a really lovely little story about Mike Oldfield. And I went out to the Bahamas with Mike Oldfield to Bimini, and was shooting him, and we had a phenomenal laugh. And then we went out swimming in the sea. I was holding my camera above my head and to keep it out of the salt water and stuff. And he was wearing a gold Lamé set of Speedos, which is
amazing.
Right, he started jumping out of the water, throwing his hair in the air, anyway, hands in the air, and it was brilliant. And we had such a laugh. And we came back on, and the journalist wouldn't go in the seat, obviously because he spent 17 of the last years in his bedroom in Leeds. But anyway, so he wouldn't come out into the sun. Sorry, that's a terrible thing to say.
It's kind of true, though, you know.
It's kind of true, isn't it? So he came out, and he was interviewed, and he came back, and he walked back up to me, Mike Oldfield, and said, "Don't think he likes me." I went, "Why?" He went, "Just don't think he gets it." I went, "What? You've made the same album for 7 times, and you're a multimillionaire. What doesn't he get?" And he burst out laughing, and we went for a swim. But that was the exact thing the journalist hadn't got.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there as a type, there is a type of person that is drawn towards that profession, and very often everything has to be a critical analysis, you know, when sometimes it just really isn't that. And I think when you live life and you're an experiencer of life and you go out there and you know, get stuck in, and you're actually a part of the action rather than, you know, deconstructing it and analyzing it.
Yes, analyzing it. Don't analyze it. Be part of it. You know, why would I be in this industry if I wasn't a part of it?
Yeah. You know, sometimes to detrimental effects, but it's about living it, isn't it?
Yeah, if I thought I was better, I wouldn't be half as good.
There's so many people I want to talk to you about, but I want to quickly ask you this as before we kind of reel off a bunch of names. When you are a wild man like you are, and you make certain changes,
not anymore. I'm just
when you make certain changes in your life, does the light creatively dim down, or do you find that the interests just shift and change, and actually your creativity is as vital and you're in tune with it as ever?
I am always 1 second away from getting overexcited. So, no. I mean, yes, I can. Yes, I obviously, like everyone else, over the last couple of years, thought, oh, this is all rubbish. You know, why are we doing this anymore? Nobody cares. But it only takes, you know, one thing, and I'm a couple of seconds away from being overexcited again. So, no, I still love it.
Have you ever done a book, like a photography book?
I was going to. The Big Book of Heavy Metal, it was going to be, with a good friend of mine. But now I'm actually starting to think about doing a series of books because, like I mentioned, James Brown and B.B. King and Diana Ross or beforehand, and I've done all of those. So I thought maybe I'd do a... Remember those old days when you used to buy encyclopedias and little part books? I thought I'd do a genre set.
Yeah.
And I could do blues and jazz, dance and techno.
I mean, you could do pop. You could do all of them.
I can do them all because I could even do classic. I can even do classical. Chiri Kananawa, I can never bloody say her name. The three tenors and all of that. I've done all of those and spent time with all of those. So from that to Iron Maiden to Slipknot,
yeah,
to James Brown, to Tiesto, and to, you know, maybe people like the Spice Girls and you know, the one thing I really missed out on, to be honest, because I was too interested in glam rock at the time, was a lot of the I was.
You love glam rock, don't you?
Oh, it's, God,
no shame.
Head out of my arse. There's no shame in that. but I missed out kind of on the Durani side of things, although I did get to shoot them later. But all that side of things, like that's the one period I missed out on.
Really. Adam Ann and Duran Duran and Police. Yeah, and
all of them. I was too into Poison, Cinderella, Motley Crue. Nothing else existed in my life at that point.
You like what you like, though, right? And you're drawn to what you love. And the range of subjects you have worked with is amazing. So Michael Jackson.
Yes.
I mean, it doesn't get bigger than that. So how many times did you work with and shoot him, and what was your experiences with him like?
Well, I shot him many times live, but I only shot him once off stage. And it was a very short photo session, which was basically commandeered by the PR. I wasn't allowed to speak to him. I wasn't allowed to ask him to do anything. I wasn't allowed to introduce myself to him. I was not allowed to do anything of those. So the first thing I did is walk up and say, "Hello, Michael. I'm Michael." The very first thing I said.
Amazing.
And you could see the PR's head about to explode.
It's one of the reasons, many reasons why I love you, Mick. This is great.
And then he went, "Oh." No, I said, "Actually, no, that's not quite true." I said, "Hi, Mick. Hi, Michael. I'm Mick." He went, "Mick, that's Michael." I went, "Yes." And he giggled and he shook my hand. Meanwhile, PR was about to throw herself off a cliff. And then we started taking some pictures, and he had these big mirror glasses on. I said, "Oh, could you take your glasses off?" To which you just heard this, "No!" behind, just as he's touching the side of his glasses. And I actually think that makes the better picture. So that's the one. But yeah, it was a very short photo session, and he is literally taken from one place to the other. It's, well, was.
A bizarre life.
But, you know, who knows? He might still be alive.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's one of those stories, isn't it, that's just layered in tragedy and strangeness.
Oh, he was in very tortured. And I don't believe any of the stuff that was said about him. I really don't. Yeah, I mean, having met him, you get a vibe for people. I just don't think so. I mean, you know, I met Jimmy Savile many years ago.
And you got a straight up vibe for him, I'll bet.
My arms went cold. 100%. I met him in a school and my arms went cold. I didn't get that feeling with Mark Jackson at all.
That's wild. Yeah, Savile's just straight up the devil incarnate.
He just told everybody he was and nobody was bloody listening.
Yeah. What was the first gig for you that kind of broke you, if you will? Like, was there one job or shoot?
Yeah, well, there was, definitely. It was, I remember doing Diana Ross for the front cover of the Sunday Times. And then that was the last job I did for David Redfern. I met a couple of people at, I think it was Select magazine at the time, Andrew Harrison. And I think my first job was to go out on tour with U2, which is brilliant because...
What time frame was this? Like their kind of 80s heyday or...?
Probably Zoo TV tour.
Right, wow.
And the brilliant thing about that was because Bono was born on the same day as me. And we went to this restaurant in Arizona. For his birthday. And I kind of mentioned just someone next to me, and it kind of went around the table. It was my birthday as well. And you two stood up and sang me happy birthday.
Amazing. Those moments, man, on tour especially. Yeah, that's when the camaraderie really comes to the fore, doesn't
day,
it?
The next day, the manager at the time, who I forget what his name is, well, I should remember, but yeah, I forget what his name is, called me into his office. I thought I was in trouble. And he came in, and they'd... got me a selection of things from the merchandise store for my birthday. An inflatable this and a t-shirt and a this, that, and the other, just presents. It was really nice. And they were great. And, you know, you're sitting in the top of a hotel in the Four Seasons, something like that, with the Edge, and you're both in matching robes. Watermelon. It's just bizarre.
Yeah. They were fantastic. They're the moments, man. They're the moments that make it, you know, when they're so removed from like reality and day to day, like, well, no,
they had the
quote unquote normal life.
The Four Seasons, you know, and with people coming in with plates of watermelon, and I'm standing there in a bathrobe with the Edge in the same bathrobe. It's just stupid. Great though.
Do you miss being on tour? And going out on the road for extended periods of time with bands?
I did.
That's a young man's game right there, isn't it?
It's a young man's game now. I will do a few dates and I will concentrate on the portraits and I will try to create something. But I'm not going to jump on a plane for the next 3 months. No.
Done your time.
I've seen the inside of too many buses.
How about David
Bowie?
And
I can never sleep the right way in a bus either. I always get it wrong.
If I'm not asleep before the bus takes off, I find it impossible to get to sleep.
You know, I've got a friend who's a bus driver, actually a tour bus driver, and he's got a little room. This is 100% true. He's got a little room downstairs when he comes back from tour next to the refrigerator. Right, so it hums and...
Gives him that comfort of the road.
Yeah, he's got a little cot and a little next to the refrigerator, and it's the only way he can get sleep for the first few days he gets home.
I mean, that right there is a window into the insanity of touring.
Well, because bus drivers have a little room sleeping above the generator.
Of course.
And so when he got home, the only way he gets sleep is to sleep next to the fridge.
How is David Bowie, Mick?
Gentleman.
Did you work a lot with him?
Not a lot. But every time I did meet him, it was he was too cool for school. You know, I mean, just so desperately cool.
Effortlessly.
Yes. And he was always dressed immaculately. I always wish I'd found out he was Taylor. He's dressed immaculately all the time.
Did you shoot the Freddie Mercury tribute gig?
Yes, I did.
That's got to be one of the best shows of all time, right?
Well, yes. I mean, with Axl Rose and Elton John coming out hand in hand, which is one of my favorite pictures, was amazing. And then again, George Michael, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, my word, he could have stepped into Freddie's shoes. What a performance.
Were you one of the main, if only, photographers shooting that? That was exclusively your gig, was it?
No, it wasn't exclusive my gig. There was other photographers there, but I did get a lot of access. And I did get to shoot the whole set of every person. Same as I did in Rock in Rio. I managed to wangle my way to do the full set of Prince and the full set of Guns N' Roses and the full set of all these different people. And Wham, actually, strangely enough, we're talking about George Michael. So that was great. And also, I was staying in a little hotel. I mean, all the bands were staying in this beautiful hotel on the front of Copacabana Beach. And I was staying in a hotel that literally had a machine that dispensed condoms outside of it.
Just next level, isn't it? Next level. How about... this is one of my favorite shots that I've seen of yours. And I've had Jazz on this show, and he's like a jester and a philosopher.
I was speaking to his manager yesterday.
Carla's great. She's awesome. But the shot of him in the hat with the cigar is an amazing photograph.
That was shot in Hyde Park, and we almost got arrested.
It looks like it could be from like the Victorian era, you know, about it.
We went for a walk in Hyde Park and just to take some pictures. And I'm taking pictures, and this police car comes up. And I was quite young at the time, so. And they said, you can't take pictures in Hyde Park because you haven't got a license or a permit or something like that. So Jazz pretended to be a school teacher, and I pretended to be the student, and we were just working out a couple of things. And then we went away and had a massive laugh and got drunk in the pub.
That's amazing. So if you do a book, Mick, or a series of books, you should definitely incorporate the stories behind the photos with the photos.
Well, yes, I would. Although I'm incredibly lazy, so I might have to just tell them to somebody and you could write them for me.
Mate, I'll help you, mate. It would be an honor. Let's talk about it, because I think from just the few that you've explained to me, like those moments that you capture, there's more that often than not an amazing story behind it that's, you know, so much more complex than just a simple point and shoot moment.
To a certain degree, I can't stand this digital age where somebody goes in, shoots it and comes out and they never even see the person. I had 2-3 days beforehand getting to know them before I took the photograph. And I think if I'm going to blow my own trumpet, which I often do, but that's what made the difference for me anyway. That's what made it enjoyable for me.
Yeah, it's all in the prep. It's all in that kind of, you know, the groundwork that you lay.
Well, I was speaking to yesterday. He left me a really lovely, lovely, lovely message. Benji from Skindred.
Yeah, love him.
And he left me a lovely message because I'm sending him a picture of the thing that we did, where we hired the A-team van.
Yeah, I know. I remember the shoot.
Right, and we had smoke bombs, and I got an AK-47 and an M16, and I put them in the back of my car. So I had an AK-47, an M16, and a bunch of smoke bombs. And this is when the whole IRA thing was going off in London. So I'm going through checkpoints thinking, fucking hell, don't look in the car. Don't look in the car. But, so, we got to this place, and we hired the A-team van. And it was probably one of the last, as he says, he left me such a lovely message saying that was probably the last time we'd ever done a shoot without Photoshop. It was just all there. We had the van, we had the smoke bombs, we had the machine guns, and we did it. And yeah, he left a lovely message on Instagram yesterday.
He's the real deal, Benji Webbers. And yeah, like me, you're an analog man in a digital world, I think, Mick. Obviously, we're doing this over Zoom right now, but you know, that's been an actual like enforced necessity in this time. But if given the option, you know, it's old school every day for me.
Well, strangely, some of my old pictures I'm giving to a friend, Roberto, who is he does platinum printing. This is like 1950s, 1940s, 1950s style printing on platinum paper. So they're going to be very, and everyone turns out different. You can't just mass produce them. So he's going to take a few of my images and he's going to work on them and print them on platinum prints. And I'm desperate to see how they're going to turn out.
Well, that's the other thing, isn't it? So let me ask you about this. This is the whole other side of the spectrum, but do you have any thoughts on this new NFT revolution?
I've been asked.
Because of the stuff that you have, for one, I'll say, is the thing of Tommy and Nikki swinging above the fire.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that is aching to be an NFT right there. And I don't even know what they are, really. But
well, I don't, to be honest, I've been asked to put them on it. I've not done one yet. But, yeah, stuff like that. I mean, people pay you for money for just having it on their screen. It's not paying you for a screensaver. I don't know. But yeah. But that one is of interest because I had that's called a cinemagraph.
Right.
And so the flames are digital, but they move and they crackle. And I've got them. You know how I shot that picture? It's an inverted picture.
Right.
Because basically I just had Tommy and Nikki bend over as far as they could backwards, shot the picture, then turned it upside down, put them on a couple of chains of the thing and put some fire underneath it. So it's actually, I've just told you the story of everybody thinks I've done that, but I didn't. I mean, that's basically I've got them bending right the way over. My God, they can bend over, I'm telling you. For the, you know, and they were literally almost bent double over backwards, took that shot, inverted it, put some chains on them, and then put some fire underneath, but it works. But yeah, that's been asked for an NFT, and so is the Aussie, and so is the Lemmy, but I would never, I don't think I would ever do the Lemmy in an Aussie as an NFT, I don't think.
No, yes.
Not until I know more about it, anyway.
Certain ones are off limits, right? Motley Crue, fair game.
Fair game. Yeah. I think they would admit that themselves.
Yeah, that's it. They'd be the first to admit. I have to ask you about Kurt Cobain.
Yes.
How was he as a man?
Well, I was on stage with him at Reading when he came out, and he's...
You did that show, did you? The famous...
Yeah.
Was it 91, 92?
Came out in a wheelchair. And I was standing on the side of the stage for that. Yeah.
What a moment. Was he cool? Yeah.
He was just sweet and lovely, very quiet. Yeah. I didn't like his girlfriend at the time.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to imagine.
I had to pour three coffees backstage because she couldn't physically put the cup underneath the coffee machine.
It's dark, isn't it? When it gets to that level, it's dark. Mm. And you see the ugly side of fame and of drugs.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank God I'm not there anymore.
It's a bit of a morbid question, this, but I'd be interested to know, has there been someone that you think you've spotted like just the biggest waste of talent because of that?
100%. I'm not going to tell you who it is.
Yeah. Okay.
But there was a name in my head, right? Yeah.
It's just heartbreaking, isn't it?
Mm.
Absolutely heartbreaking.
Drugs came before the music. And I think the drugs came before the music right at the start. And then they got kind of famous for the music. And then they could afford better drugs. It was always going to be gone downhill from there.
Do you ever practice, Mick? Like, do you ever just go out and shoot to practice like, you know, a musician would practice? Or do you always want to be with a subject and only really shoot when you're doing it for real?
I mean, I keep my arm in, you know, I keep my hand in, doing stuff. Because if you don't, you do forget slightly. But no, I kind of work off the person that's in front of me. And look, if you can't take pictures, like the thing is, people are obsessed with cameras, shutter speeds, apertures, this, that, and the other. You should know that. That should just be, you know, suck your finger, put it in the air and go, well, that's F8. You know, I mean, it should be natural. So when something comes, you're working with the person and taking photographs. You're not thinking about what the camera's doing. If you're thinking about what the camera's doing, you're not doing what the photographer should be doing. And the photographer should be talking to the person in front of them.
I like that. I've got a camera and I'm looking to get into photography, Mick. I'd love to come and just study and shadow you one day if you're ever open to having a little nuisance assistant around.
Oh, no, absolutely. But I will do something that I do to people, which is I take their lovely brand spanking new digital camera with their lovely screen on the back.
Put it in the drawer and give it an old one.
No, and what I do is I tape over the screen with a bit of masking tape. I set the whole camera on manual, and you have to go out and take 36 shots because only ever 36 shots on a film, and you're not allowed to look at them until they come back.
Amazing. That sounds great.
And then you'll learn how to take pictures.
Wow. Okay. You in Brighton? Is that where the boat is?
That's right. Yeah.
Mate, I'll come down if that's all right.
Yeah, we'll go out for the day.
We'll come down, chat about doing some writing.
And look through a viewfinder as opposed to looking at looking at the screen, look through the viewfinder, create the picture. Because remember, back in the day, we used to, God, I sound so desperately old. But back in the day, we used to shoot negative and use filed out carriers. No, I don't know anybody knows what I'm talking about here, but you used to have an enlarger and the carrier used the thing you hold the negative in. But if you filed it out, you could get the little black line around it, right? And so that was a full frame picture. So whenever you look through the camera, you were taking a photograph full frame. So you basically edited, designed everything through the lens, through the viewfinder and the lens.
Yeah.
Because the image at the end was going to be full frame. So that's another thing. I mean, people take pictures and then they recrop them in Photoshop. Why don't you just take a picture in the first place? Sorry, yeah. I'm getting a but you know, do that. Then they use, you know, Lightroom to change the exposure. Well, if you're shooting on transparency film, which is a third of a stop latitude, and you've just traveled halfway across the world to do this and come back, you ain't got a chance to, you know, change it. So it's very few things. And you know, photography is easy. You know, it's just a very small amount of maths and a lot of opening your eyes and conversation. And if you get those three things right, you can, it doesn't matter what you've got in your hand.
And the conversation and the open of eyes and mind part is my whole attitude and approach to life and what I love the most about meeting anyone, you know, whether it's in a professional context or just on the street. You know, going to buy your groceries or whatever, people are what make me excited about what I do. And working with
exciting. Every single person has got a story.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, the other show that I do with Jesse from Killswitch Engage, we have on listeners as guests on the show and we just chat to them, you know, for about an hour and a half sometimes about their life. And some of the most fascinating stories we've heard have just been from, you know, listeners of the show who've gotten in touch. Everybody's got one.
Everyone has one, you know, and never forget that, you know, you don't know what's going on inside someone, no matter what they're showing on the outside.
What's left for you, Mick? Are there any things, you know, with someone like you who's done so much, is there anything left that you'd still really love to do, either creatively or personally? Or
yeah, I'm working on something quite interesting now, which is a collaboration between a couple of artists, The Postman and Paul Stavely, who are different kind of artists. One's a, the postman's kind of a bit like Banksy, he's a street artist, and Paul Stavely does massive murals, and they're taking some of my old classics, we're blowing them up to like 10 foot by 6 foot, and they're painting on the top of them. And so the next exhibition that's going to come up is going to be unlike anything you've ever seen.
Amazing. Yeah, that's I think, a whole new world of potential, isn't it, when you mix media and bring different people from different walks of the artistic world together, combine powers.
They can often see things that you didn't.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really exciting when they do something, you go, God, that's great.
So my final question to you, Mick, is this, and this has been awesome, man, as I knew it would be, and I feel like I could talk to you for hours and hours more, but an hour is kind of a nice place, I think, to end it after. I inquire as to, you mentioned Shania Twain earlier, and you know, you've photographed some of the most beautiful women on earth in your life. Who have been some of the ones for you? You know, obviously physical beauty is important, but as we both know, when you're in a room with someone, certain people just have a chemistry and a presence and an aura about them. Who have been some of the most just spellbindingly beautiful subjects? And maybe they could be male too, but you know, who have been the ones for
totally,
you? That...
I mean, totally. Well, Shirley Manson is the sweariest girl I have ever met in my life.
I love her. I'd love to get her on this show. She's amazing.
Hilarious, right? But the sweariest woman I have ever... I mean, it's just a one long bleep, right? And she's stunning, you know, and funny. And so I have a bit of a soft spot for her because I quite like sweary women. Other than that, Shania Twain was just exactly, she's just like in her videos. Well, it doesn't, I don't think she's making it up at all. That's just her. It's just hilarious. And she's drop dead gorgeous. I mean, yes. Kylie, sweetie, just sweetie, sweetie. And Scary Spice, had a bit of a thing for her.
Yeah. I love it. Everyone had their favorite. Mine was Jerry.
Never liked Jerry. Scary.
No. Mate, you, what a life. What a life, man. And thank you for this. This has been really cool just to catch up
really
more than anything.
You again. Really lovely.
And I'm really happy.
See you together soon.
Yeah, for sure. I'll hit you up, man, because I wasn't just saying that. I'd really love to come down and spend some time with you. And, you know, I bought a camera just before COVID hit. And because, you know, there's so many situations where I've had access to all these amazing people through interviewing them. And, you know, I look back through all the years that I've been doing it. I think, man, if only I'd had a camera all that time, I could have taken some really incredible photos.
I think some of the best photographs I've not taken are the things that allowed me to do some of the best photographs I did. Because it allowed me to be with that person, them to trust me.
Yeah.
So yes, I could have got some, you know, quite shocking.
No doubt.
But because I didn't, I was then allowed to do the pictures I could do.
Yeah. And it all comes back to people, relationships, respect, trust, which some people in the industry will never get and understand. But I think real recognizes real, and that's why so many artists have, you know, loved working with you. It's because you're the real deal, mate.
No, thank you so much, sir.
I'll be seeing you soon. Nice one, Mick. Cheers, buddy.
Love you. Bye.
Love you too, man.
Well, there we go. That was me and Mick Hudson in conversation just a few weeks ago. And that was episode 288 of Life in the Stocks. There's nothing really left to add, except rest in peace, Mick. And I just want to express my deepest, sincerest admiration and respect and love for that man and everything that he did for me. We weren't the best of friends, as I said, but the occasions that we shared were deeply meaningful and profound, and and uplifting and inspiring to me. And he was just a wonderful, kind, caring, brilliant, talented, one-of-a-kind dude. And he will be sorely, sorely missed. So, Mick, we love you. Rest in peace, brother.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.